Thanks, Matt. Actually, I did notice a bit of music coming through as Julian was giving his commercial near the end there. So I thought I'd just say what the IPA is before. And a lot of you wouldn't know, we're a think tank, we're an independent think tank. We're financed by individuals, mainly businesses, I guess. We're not a consultancy. We're involved very much in small government. We favour small government. We favour deregulation, which is one of the ogres that Julian mentioned. But we do favour deregulation, we do favour privatisation, we do favour getting government out of the way, allowing businesses to operate on their own. I too, like Matt, have been involved in Part 3A in Hilmer since the outset, and a couple of years ago I wrote a book, co-wrote a book anyway, on regulation of infrastructure with Warren Pengelly, which I've got a few copies if anybody wants to see them. I think that we're all agreed that open competition and private enterprise does give firms considerable incentive to discover and meet demands at lowest cost. And monopolies, where they're not challengeable, do bring excessive costs. And the 1993 Hilmer report and subsequently Australian government recognised that sheltering activities, which in those days were mainly government-owned monopolies, sheltering these from competition did impair productivity. Now, since then, because rival facilities can no longer be excluded, the risk of this is much reduced. But even so, we do have access regimes like Part 3A have been introduced and are in place. The effects, access regimes are departures, as Matt said, from the standard rules that promote efficiency by allowing owners to use their property as they please, as long as they don't harm others. And inevitably, forcing firms to offer access to their facilities also entails the prospect of a regulated price. It's no good saying, you know, we really want a commercial price, we want this. In the end, you have John File in the background and his associates as a regulator who will determine the price. It's a regulated, it's a commercial negotiation with one player with his hand behind his back. Now, in the short term, a price that's regulated, and of course all prices are regulated, must be regulated below market levels. Nobody requires the buyer to buy these things. A lower cost, it means lower cost for users and therefore higher demand. But over the longer term, regulated prices are likely to undermine incentives to maintain facilities and to modernise them. And these are exacerbated, these concerns are exacerbated where rate regulation drives revenues towards variable costs, and indeed some of the early judgments, one of the first judgments on this was pre-Hilmer, Pont Securities, but some of you were involved in it in those days. Justice Murray Wilcox set a price for access to the Australian Stock Exchange by Pont of just $100 a year, which of course, if everybody paid $100 a year, you would never have the major facility at the Stock Exchange in there in the first place. Australians recount that owners of essential facilities must offer to all comers, even competitors. These rules amplify developments that have come through the US courts. In the US, a threshold test for government involvement specified that an asset would be, quote, impracticable to duplicate. US law recognized the inefficiencies which are pregnant with requiring access and sought limited scope. Recognizing this, that economic incentives flow from requiring firms to relinquish their property rights, Hilmer also was keen to define an essential facility, and he adopted the US perspective in the report, which said clearly access to the facility should be essential rather than merely convenient. Part 3A actually broadened this to 44G, where it said that it would be uneconomical for anyone to develop another facility to provide the service. So it's a much broader, opens the gate much wider, but mindful that the dangers of this, and this was part of Hilmer also, the dangers of this regulatory overreach, production processes were excluded from the regulatory control. And there's been a great deal written on this, on the whole matter, but one influential book by Stephen King, who was formerly a commissioner of the ACCC, and Rodney Maddock, discussed their concerns that this test of uneconomical to develop another facility could really bring a whole lot of facilities within the ambit if it wasn't carefully applied. They looked at situations where, you know, you may even have three or four or five or six facilities, but another one would not be justified, and some estimates of what the costs were, and therefore it would be required to be opened to competition. And so they, and they clearly thought that this could be quite deleterious, and counseled that we need to ensure that it didn't happen. The NCC didn't really have any such problems with it, and John Fowle's predecessor, Graham Samuel, really saw this as a great opportunity to building an building and activating gas and electricity networks is extremely expensive, but sending more gas or current around the network once it's operated is relatively cheap. Clearly, rather than making a competitor build a second network to compete with the existing network, it would make more economic sense in that situation to give the competitor access to the existing network. I think Julian's going to apply for the job when he comes vacant soon, because he said something similar just a little while ago. But it is a marked extension from Hilmar. Cost and risk management are, I think, key features of a firm's decision to make or buy in parts of an end product. Products that are critically dependent on various components being brought together precisely as required, the supply will often need a premium service and frequently a built-in redundancy of availability. With highly integrated production systems, product and transport is required to be available on demand. And this is a characteristic of rail lines transporting bulk products to ports and power stations. The transport services being contracted, therefore, often comprise a guarantee that the services can be undertaken, and not necessarily when they're planned. While it's possible to arrange for this service to be brought in, doing so often involves highly complex contracts where there are supply uncertainties. And obviously, it's preferable in some cases to do this in-house, as the iron ore companies are doing, including FMG as well, with its major facility. This requirement for in-house, or the advisability of in-house, was recognised also by the previous government's infrastructure task force, and which said, I'll just quote a bit of it, the difficulties associated with physical coordination of complementary investments are greatly complicated by disputes over the division of the gains from those investments. Historically, vertical integration between infrastructure providers and the activities that most rely on their services has been a way of avoiding these complications. Difficulties in organising all parties required for complementary investment to occur and in securing agreement as to the sharing of the costs of needed capacity expansions can paralyse the capacity expansion process, perpetuating bottlenecks. Now, there are a lot of cases of that. UK rail track is a very clear example of what can go wrong when de-integration is made mandatory. Coordinating a vertically unbundled British rail proved too difficult due to track being separately owned. The different interests of the network enhancement to improve safety and the lack of expanding usage led to inadequate investment and a deterioration of track quality and then disasters. Rail and rolling stock are jointly providing and force the track to be independent, forcing it to be independent, creates an economic incentive problem. The two incentives of the rail owner and the track owner clash, and you can avoid this, theoretically at least, by contracting, but it can be prohibitively complex. So whether a supplier chooses to integrate or contract to ensure delivery precisely as required will, if the costs of missing a desired delivery time are high, ensure considerable redundancy in the process. And that redundancy is not capacity which is, quote, surplus to needs, but represents a supply buffer to meet certain eventualities. Just if we look at some of the outcomes of requiring access to a couple of industries, gas and rail terminals, regulators have frequently claimed, and sometimes have commissioned research to prove this, that the gas access regime has delivered considerable gains to the economy. In other words, requiring gas pipe owners to share has brought considerable gains. The chairman of the ACCC rejected the claim, which was made by the Productivity Commission, that the regulation had a chilling effect on investments in the industry. However, there has been no new pipeline built in Australia on the expectation that it would be regulated. We've seen adverse experiences with regulation influencing some investment decisions. Sea gas pipelines from Victoria to Adelaide was built with the intention of avoiding any regulatory costs and distortions of coverage. The partners actually inflexibly designed the capacity to prevent any availability for other users and therefore any case for declaration. And in doing so, they avoided then or neglected to build in any increased capacity, which can be done at a relatively low cost. Therefore, it did probably represent some optimal investment. Julian mentioned the coal terminals. Well, it's difficult to see, but certainly the one case we have of the coal terminals in Queensland, the one which was integrated, which is BHP's, Hay Point, they saw a demand expanding and within 3 years had commissioned a major expansion. Dalrymple Bay, which has got multi-owners and various other difficulties to try to get such an expansion, leading to a lot of argy-bargy, took at least another year longer to get there. Mention of the Pilbara rail lines, of course, it's very topical and even more topical today. We've got the Premier here looking to gain something from it. We've had two federal court cases. Robe River, which was 98, I think, or 99, but Justice Kenny determined that access was not justified because the rail facility was part of an integrated production process, and she said by which a marketable commodity is created or manufactured and therefore was excluded from the coverage. BHP Billiton versus the NCC, Justice Middleton considered this to be incorrect. Now, the rail lines, as Julian said, were developed through a state agreement. But the state agreement was quite limited. The parties agreed to carry people and freight to third parties, and all this, of course, will be rehearsed ad nauseum over the next few months. But it was highly conditional. It was without unduly prejudicing or interfering with its operations. The state government agreed to facilitate the removal of government barriers, but it didn't actually place any unusual call on government funds or facilities that might require some sort of pre quo quo. Rio Tinto and BHP both have integrated their iron ore facilities around Pilbara. Each firm's lines are at present almost exclusively for their own use. They're obviously going to search out ways in which they can actually dovetail some of that use in their merger or semi-merger. And FMG is to build its own line and really is only seeking access to BHP for a small deposit. So this would actually mean there are three separate rail lines in the Pilbara region. That's quite a deal of competition. At least the three companies that were and still are, in principle, totally competitive one with the other, cutthroatly so in many ways. The fact that none of these three are being made available, at least the present two that are fully operational, to unrelated parties, does indicate the sorts of things I was talking about, that the line that they need to totally control the integrated system. That there is no spare capacity, or that they need some inbuilt redundancy. In any event, the track owners see contracting to transport for an unrelated entity as placing too great a risk on their business. I think when Julian sees, you know, that BHP will actually gain from this, I mean, BHP, if there's anybody here, would say, well, you know, please, we'll decide what we gain from. We don't see it that way, and free advice from others is usually not worthwhile. And indeed, when we're talking in terms of there is spare capacity, there's a lot of spare capacity. You've got spare capacity in your house, there's a third bedroom. Why don't we make that available to somebody else? Well, we don't do so because it creates a certain disincentive to actually building a house and owning a house in the future, and the same sort of provisions go with infrastructure. I think the interesting thing about the BHP-NCC process, it did bring some very prominent economists into making their own judgments, and in fact, invariably, they decided that, in fact, that there was no case for declaration in terms of the economics. The law is a different matter. One of the most influential ones was Professor Ordova, who'd been used by the regulatory authorities in the past, indeed in the case of the Eastern Gas Pipeline. He said that it should be declared that pipeline because there is only one pipeline. But he took a totally different view. He's an interventionist economist. He's not a free market economist. Or I wouldn't think he would be pleased to be called a free market economist. But he did regard the fact that there are already two, and there are likely to be three, facilities as trumping any theoretical views that there's only a single facility and therefore requiring any sharing of it. As we know, in the past 10 years, iron ore in Australia has more than doubled, and that means a doubling of infrastructure is necessary. Various economists looking at the BHP Pilbara one came to conclusions that the regulatory intrusion is bringing about delays in investment. Some say, perhaps maliciously, that's a strategy of FMG to actually impair decisions of a competitor. And I say that's perhaps malicious, but that's an argument she's made by some. But certainly the future controls, the possibility that these facilities may be open does add a risk premium. Let me just talk very briefly in the minute or so left. Businesses will normally willingly share facilities with all parties as long as they get adequate recompense. And there are a lot of businesses which have only got one customer. Indeed, here in Western Australia, there's one oil refinery which is owned by BP. It serves 22 different crude-producing fields in the Perth area. The owners of these fields have got two options. They can go to BP, or three options, I guess. They can build their own refinery, go to BP, or ship to Singapore. It's not an edifying prospect, and BP would clearly and quite properly exploits its location to the full terms in what it charges, and these wells do provide about 15% of the refinery throughput. So the notion of a central facility milking the market for all it's worth is basically what drives business, and it's quite proper. Nobody suggests it isn't. And in terms of manufacturing. The neat segregation, and I agree here with you, the neat segregation of manufacturing from other things is totally meaningless. It means nothing, never did mean anything. It was put in as an oh my god moment from the point of view of Hilmer to say, look, we could be nationalising, socialising all sorts of facilities. Let's excise at least manufacturing from it, because I disagree. I think the Holden plant is a very significant facility, and it might well be worthwhile somebody trying to get on there. Just a couple of concluding comments then. Many businesses opt for vertical ownership for a variety of reasons, including to maintain control, and in some cases for built-in redundancy for unforeseen eventualities. Australian law has made an exception for production processes, and I think that this is not a useful exception. I think there's already been considerable economic damage in terms of delays to development across different industries that Part 3A has brought, and I think that the Pilbara one is an interesting case in mind. In Australia today, the infrastructure developer has got no franchise protection and will always be vulnerable to competition. A regulatory model featuring price or profit control will prevent it, at the very least, or deter major new investments. Policy basis must be founded on an automatic expectation that any new investment should be unregulated and, in line with regulators' frequent assertions that markets are superior to regulatory agencies in getting efficiency, that regulation should be removed as soon as possible, as soon as more than one supply source is in place. And we do have a long way to go in terms of people getting access at the present time to the Rio and the BHP facilities. I agree with that. Thank you.